Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Paul Ginn, alongside Jeremy Espy. And for the next hour, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, you will get a heavy dose of our opinion. And if you have an opinion, the number to call is 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. And you can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/pgan. That's blogtalkradio.com/pgan. And you can send email messages to the show at goforit.gant@gmail.com. That's goforit.gant@gmail.com. Jeremy?
Paul? How are you?
How are you, sir?
You know, I couldn't be better. I had a great preseason game. Quarterback looks great. You know, things are looking up in Philly.
My quarterback, Donovan McNabb, didn't look too bad.
He threw an interception.
Did throw a pick. Granted, he was going up against a better defense than Cobb played against.
He did throw a pick.
He did throw for 206 yards, and watching the game, there were a few drops by his receiver, so his percentages also could have been a lot better. But anyway, I mean, it's preseason football at the end of the day. And if you're going to get excited for preseason football, then
not preseason football. We, Rachel and I, were just looking at some of the, you know, restaurants on restaurants.com, you know, Capital Grill.
Look for the restaurants, but I think at the end of the day, I'll be the one looking for restaurants at that website or others in the worldwide web. But we're expected to be joined by the first Black starting quarterback, Marlon Briscoe, who will talk about his life and talk about what's going on with him now. Apparently there's a movie in production called The Magician, which chronicles his life and his situation. And then if you look back on it now, I mean, obviously in today's NFL, I mean, black quarterbacks are plentiful and they're abound. But there was a time in the NFL where many black quarterbacks did not get opportunities. And many, unfortunately, were forced to switch positions. And Marlon was one of them who fell under that. And he's going to talk about that today. And if you look at the lineage there, you go back, Doug Williams obviously was the first to win a Super Bowl back in 1987. But the actual first black quarterback was Willie Thrower. He came in, he played for the Chicago Bulls. He wasn't a starter, but he did get some playing time. But, I mean, if you look at the history and everything, you realize that a lot of these guys who were talented and had some ability to play the position weren't allowed to play the glamour and marquee position of the quarterback position. And, unfortunately, these guys, like I said, were forced to switch positions. If you look at it now, I guess if a guy like Michael Vick was around in the 60s, and even in the 70s, you would think that guy probably would be a running back or a D-back or a wide receiver or another position. So, I mean, it should be interesting to talk to Marlon and get his perspective on that and, talk about it. I mean, because he's a guy that paved the way for some guys that we see today. And so, I mean, like I said, you see the guys today, you think about it, and you don't realize the issues and the problems that a lot of black quarterbacks in the past have had getting to become a starting quarterback. So it should be interesting to get his take.
And you brought up Michael Vick, and over the weekend there's more of a Albert Haynesworth saga. It's going to be very unique to get Mr. Briscoe's take on what he just as a person had to endure. And here you have players, athletes, quote, unquote, professionals, and, you know, what they're doing and the problems and the trials and tribulations that – look at a guy like Albert Haynesworth, what he supposedly is facing, and just get a unique perspective on what's real, you know, Paul, and what's we're asked to, you know, to believe. How hard is it to be Albert Haynesworth? And to get a perspective like that, to me, is certainly very unique.
And it's unfortunate because he was a guy who came in for the Broncos, started 11 games, threw for 14 touchdowns as a rookie, which is a record still today for the franchise, threw for over 1,500 yards. And at the end of the year, he was released. And, I mean, granted, the Broncos didn't have a great record that particular season, but he was released. And, unfortunately, he had to switch positions, and he ended up with the Bills and ultimately with the Dolphins. And he eventually retired in 1976. He also played for the Lions and the Chargers as well. And ultimately, he retired in 76. And, that was the end of his career. But, again, if you look back on it, it's kind of a shame that a guy wasn't given the opportunity to be able to play the quarterback position, the position that he wanted to play, the position that he excelled at early in his career. So it's unfortunate, but it also is life. And like you said about a guy like Albert Haynesworth and others, I mean, you kind of take it for granted that, you know, that a lot of people have paved the way for you in order for you to have the opportunity to go out there and to play the game that you love to play and to make the money that you make. And I'm not just picking on Albert Haynesworth because there's a lot of dogs out there too, whether it's white, black, or what have you. There's a lot of guys out here who don't always play the hardest and don't always do the necessary things to be successful.
Well, but Paul, you don't have to pick on Haynesworth. I mean, you saw over the weekend. I mean, listen, I think that the whole – it's spiraling so out of control. I mean, it's not, you know, Haynesworth and Shanahan too, though, in a way, is becoming like, come on, man. This is a player on your team who certainly is a starting nose tackle, defensive tackle in the NFL on any NFL team. And to say over the weekend that he should have been out there in the third quarter, or to put him out there in the third quarter, the two of them are acting like they're acting like children. It's comical. It's, believe me, I think it's great TV. I love watching the NFL Network over the weekend to watch the takes and the outtakes and to hear Shanahan today. I mean, it's like two little kids in a schoolyard. They really should just go out back and Haynesworth should just, you know, whoop them one and then they could kind of go about their business. But at the end of the day, I think if I'm Albert Haynesworth, one lesson I'm going to learn is, look, Shanahan's the coach. He's going to be there. I'm going to just shut my mouth because the more I say, it seems like the more I'm going to have to endure.
But if you look at it also, Albert apparently did have some condition, some kind of bone condition, which I won't even try to pronounce. But apparently this condition may have caused some headaches and may have caused some bone pain and things of that nature. And that was the real reason why Albert was not playing, because of that particular condition. And, Jeremy, if you can try, I mean, maybe you can try to pronounce it.
I work for doctors, Paul. We all know that. You know, I tell these doctors what to do and what to say. But
lysis or something like that.
How about, Paul, how much do you really believe that medical condition was that, that debilitating? And that's why I say,
fatal, but in some cases, but again, I don't.
So is walking out your door every day, Paul.
That's true.
I mean, at the end of the day, I just think it was sad to see it again this weekend. I mean, look, I'll tell you, if I'd have been on the field in the third quarter, and I'm Albert Haynesworth, you got guys out there that, bottom line, they do not know how to play professional football. And it's just like, you know, Chad Johnson said over the weekend, that hit that he took against the Eagles was a little – let's keep it real again. It was a little bit more than what I think they needed to do in the preseason. And I agree with those comments and that that's one of the rare times I'm ever going to agree with a Twitter, or a tweet, if you will. But I think that, you know, for him to be out, for Haynesworth, though, to be out there in the third quarter is just, that's embarrassing. And it's so petty. I just think that sports, and you and I speak a lot about it, I think sports is becoming, it's more petty, I think, now than it's at an all-time high. And that's why I say I'm excited, I think, to hear from a guy who really, you know, he defined a position for a race and took the brunt of that.
Exactly. And, you know, it's you're right. And in a lot of ways, it's like you said, it was sad that he had to go through all that just to play the game that he loves and the game that he was pretty good at, quite frankly. But in reality, he did latch on as a wide receiver and had a productive career and ultimately won two rings with the Dolphins, was a part of the undefeated 72 Dolphins. So, I mean, he made something of himself and he fought through the situation and ultimately he became successful. But again, you look back on it and you just wish that guys would not have to go through those particular things. You just really do. And, I mean, the guys deserve to get on the field. If you're good enough, you deserve to be on the field. Granted, it was a different era and a different time in our society. But, I mean,
but you look at, too, Paul, you look at the fact that here's a guy that knew in order – the sacrifice he made, you know, in today's world, when you're telling a defensive tackle basically that we want you to play that position just in a different scheme of a defense – He's not being asked to be moved to an offensive tackle or a defensive lineman or a linebacker, you know, or a guard or a fullback. He's being told it's just a different scheme. It's the same position, it's a different scheme. And here's a guy that also, with 11 players, with $100 million, $42 million guaranteed, is greater than the whole. You know, and that's why, but there's example on every team. I mean, you know, Chris Johnson with the Titans, he's holding out. Well, I mean, Darrell Revis, he's not playing, and he's under contract.
But I think at the same time, those are different situations. Those are guys who have outplayed their contracts. Chris Johnson did come in, but Darrell Revis is a guy who's outplayed his contract and deserves to be compensated for doing so.
Well, Marlon has a great you know, rookie season, and for that, he was basically sent to asylum, if you will, and then comes back as a wide receiver. I mean, but you know what? But it's guys like him who paved the way. And I wonder if these actions are what he works. You know, I wonder if his pride to go from a quarterback to a wide receiver, even though he was talented at a wide receiver position, he may have enjoyed playing it, but I certainly think, obviously, his first true love was the quarterback position. But I wonder, Paul, you know, if anyone remembers that. I wonder if Darrell Revis remembers that there are guys not too long ago that are still living today that were – they were taken away from the league. I mean, here's a guy who has a great rookie season. Paul, he had a rookie season – that still today would win you, I think, a lot of accolades. And it holds up today. I mean, and you have players that are 2-3 years in their contract, and I understand it's a business, but it's just astounding. I think it's such a relatively short period of time from a historical standpoint to see how far things have gotten, how different the leagues all professional sports are today. How much of a business is and are sports today as opposed to even 20 or 30, 40 very short years ago?
You're right. I mean, things have changed, definitely.
Where a guy wasn't even paid $10,000 in a season to they're talking about Peyton Manning's contract being $20 to $25 million per year, based on the money, the rookie monies, and the monies that these players are getting today. And they're saying that Manning's deal, one of the holdups or the holdup is finding out what is his number, considering his brother Eli, who's making $18 million a year. And so obviously Peyton has to be paid superior to his brother.
Right, but I mean.
$18 million. I just couldn't.
I don't know if the comparison is fair, because again, different age, different era, and almost in a lot of ways, different situations. I don't think you really can necessarily compare the two.
But look at contextually. Look at how different the NFL. I am stuck on NFL numbers in that there are 16 games, Paul. And if Peyton Manning comes within a chip shot of $20 to $25 million, Alex Rodriguez, who's the highest paid professional athlete, you know, in a major sport, makes $25 million a year. But he plays 100 or their sport is 163 games. I just think it will be extreme, beyond impressive, beyond words, to see a pay scale that is very much, if not all bar, is very paralleled to where a team is playing literally almost 150 less games, and you're on the same pay scale per game.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the NFL, Paul, is nothing short. It's nothing short of a statistical anomaly from a money, from a dollars and cents standpoint. It really is it's very different. You look at the Major League Baseball, what they have to do, how many games they have to generate for the per unit revenue versus the NFL. I mean, if the NFL had a game 52 weeks a year, Paul, and we all kind of know this, the craze will still be there. You can't get enough NFL, and then you have baseball, it's the same. I mean, football is not a 2-hour game. It's a, you know, 3-4 hour event. It's the same kind of length and duration. But they have, for whatever you know, the gods, if you will, have put upon them, they are certainly a blessed league in that they control the destinies.
True. I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, with the NFL, the way it's set up, a lot of contracts are not guaranteed. Most of the contracts are not guaranteed. What tends to be guaranteed is the signing bonus. So in that situation, the coaches kind of have the leverage in those leagues, more so in baseball, more so in basketball, and even more so in hockey at this point. And with these guaranteed contracts, the leverage goes away from the coaches and it goes to the players. When you have a situation in the NFL, the coaches tend to have a lot of the leverage there. So it's a kind of with having the leverage, they're in control. And so, the situations are different. And when you're talking about Revis and all those guys, I don't know if you can necessarily...
Well, but I guess, Paul, I guess the only thing that I look at these players and I said to you, like, I just wonder what player will be the impetus and the nexus of the NFL saying, I mean, the bottom line is that in a way it is the most replaceable sport in terms of a player. There are no players that in the NFL come close to Michael Jordan at his fame prime, and certainly LeBron James at his prime. So to me, I wonder where is this sport going in terms of a per athlete, you know, direction. It seems every year there's another 3 or 4 NFL players who, yeah, they're at the top of their position. Chris Johnson certainly is a great running back, and I don't mean to seem, sarcastic when I say all of this, because I do think he's a great player. Maybe this is this. Definitely best defensive back, not even just a cornerback. Best probably defensive back in the AFC. Probably best defensive back in the league. But they're still very young. I mean, they're still not. They have not put that kind of work in the league to make and these statements they're making, preparing themselves to sit out for a full year. And if anything, the league will invariably, and they do, the teams invariably do give in to these athletes, and creating the same vortex of the player controls the destiny mentality. Rookie contracts, the holdouts for rookies, they can hold out, and there's no punishment to them, and they've never played it down, and they're sitting out for, you know, 6 weeks of a season at times, and there's no thought or no theory of what, if anything, or where, if anything, you know, the league, I think, is going to put their foot down and say, but we don't need, you know, Chris Johnson. We don't need Darrelle Revis. You don't command the money-making capabilities.
Hello, you're on Go For It. Hello?
Caller,
are you there? Caller is not there. We're waiting for Marlon Briscoe, the former out of the first black starting quarterback to call in. Like I said, it should be interesting to get his take on his situation and what happened with him and kind of see where he's at right now and kind of get his thoughts. I mean, it should be interesting to get those particular thoughts. Well, everybody, it's official. It's official. Tiger Woods and Elin are divorced.
You're crazy, Paul.
You're crazy. You're applauding divorce, Paul?
I'm not applauding it, but
we go from a heavy discussion on player salaries to and Marlon calling in talking about the NFL and this, you know, his trials and tribulations to applauding divorce.
I'm not applauding it per se. You know, let's not go. I'm a proponent of marriage, and you know, I support marriages all across the land. Just was interesting that this was where it came down, and but it was rumored that apparently at some point she was going to get $750 million. We don't know how true that is, but obviously after all the fun that Tiger had, I guess the marriage was broken. So unfortunately, it's these two were not together, and it's over. It's over.
I don't know why we have to vilify this poor guy anymore.
The marriage was over
I'm
for
not
a while.
The guy. I just don't
well, we're laughing at him. We're laughing at him. You know, you're laughing at him. I think again, Paul. Like, you know, look, the marriage was. They were divorced. Beginning of the year, they were divorced when he slammed his Cadillac into the guardrail. I mean, now, if anything, all you're doing is kicking a guy while he's down. And also, again, I mean, look, he made his own bed. He's going to lay in it. And I think I've always contended it's interesting how she's going to sign a divorce, whether the amount of millions she gets. The one thing from all of that I took from it is basically she sold herself. And I don't care what anyone says. You want to speak negatively of Tiger Woods, well, there should be a lot that needs to go around, because if she was so convicted, you know, and when so betrayed by Tiger, signing a settlement that she gets to never talk again, even after his death, tells me who she is. And I know we're going to come back to it. I know we have
the first starting black quarterback, Marlon Briscoe. Marlon?
Hey.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Now, Marlon, you're a guy. You came out of the University of Nebraska, Omaha. You were a top-flight quarterback there. At the time, there weren't no black starting quarterbacks. Did you think your only way to get into the league was to switch to another position? Because you were actually drafted as a defensive back.
Yeah, I was drafted as a defensive back, but when I structured my contract, which I negotiated myself, I had a clause included that I get a three-day trial at quarterback. I knew that Denver was one of the, probably the only or few teams that had held their practices before the media and before the fans right there in Denver. And all I wanted was a forum to showcase, you know, my skills and just get an opportunity to show what I could do. And, you know, I was a 14th round draft choice, they thought I was crazy, you know, to demand a contract like that. But I was pretty adamant about it. So, you know, eventually they acquiesced to my so-called demands and gave me a three-day trial at quarterback. And I knew it was not going to be a level playing field, but, you know, we were back in the 60s where for African Americans there was no level playing field on any field. And, you know, I did very well during the 3 days, although I didn't get the reps that the other eight quarterbacks that were in camp. But I made the best of it, and, you know, the press kind of picked up on it a little bit. And so, you know, eventually, you know, after the third day, they hurried up and got me out of there. And I ended up being Denver's starting corner during the preseason. Unfortunately, I got hurt. But, yeah, that's how it happened.
Now, during your rookie season, as you got in there, the starting quarterback was hurt. You were able to step in. And then eventually you had an impressive season, throwing 14 touchdowns, 1,500 yards in 11 games. And what kind of pressure was it when you finally stepped in and was the guy?
Well, to me it wasn't any pressure. You know, I've been the first black quarterback virtually all my life, from Pop Warner to elementary to junior high to high school, and eventually to college. So I wasn't intimidated or never really thought of myself as a black quarterback. I just felt I was a guy that was playing the position. And that's the way that's the attitude that I had taken into Denver, that I was a quarterback. And you know, I never looked at the color of my skin being a detriment or a plus. I looked at it as, you know, I had always looked at it. You know, I'm the quarterback of this team. I've got to lead, think, and throw. And that's the way I approached it. I never, you know, I as a matter of fact, I didn't really realize the significance of being the first black quarterback until Ebony came and did like a four-page spread on it. And then I realized, well, this is a pretty big deal, you know, for the black community. And, you know, I knew at that point that, hey, I can't fail. You know, if I fail, then all the naysayers would say, well, I told you so, black can't think through a lead. But it wasn't until Ebony really came out with that huge spread, I really realized it began to sink into me how important it was, you know, for the black community and the black quarterbacks of the future.
So Marlon, it's interesting, and you mentioned the article that Ebony magazine did with you. Coming out of that season and going into the off season and then training camp and getting released from the Broncos, I guess – not just surprised, but what was the emotions there for you?
Well, it was a heck of a disappointment, because after throwing a rookie record, runner up for rookie of the year, being the starting quarterback at the end of the season, bringing fans into the season, into the stands, galvanizing, you know, the players on our team who, you know, who stuck with me and played for me, you know, including, you know, a lot of white athletes who, prior to coming into the NFL, had never played with a black player, let alone a black quarterback, because they're white players from the South. And to have them rally around me, and it kind of allayed fears with management that, first of all, there would be a fan backlash. That wasn't so, because more fans came to the game after I started playing. And then, you know, the fear that, you know, the players around me, you know, would not rally around me. and that was not the, that was not the case. So, you know, all the naysayers were disproved in 1968. And I talked, you know, I go to a lot of our Denver Bronco reunions. And our 1968 team, we had more representatives from that team to come to the event than most of the reunion attendees. And, you know, they, to a man, they said, well, we could have won with you. But they couldn't say that back then. You
right.
know, back in those days, you know, you had to keep your mouth shut and just play. And but when I go to these reunions and these guys, you know, tell me that they think they could have won with me, we had a pretty good team. We won some games. And
well, I mean, and one of the things, that's one of the things Paul and I were speaking on right before, you know, to introduce and go over your career. I mean, your rookie season statistically holds up in the modern era. I mean, you had 17 total touchdowns. You ran for, you know, 300 and over 300 yards, which again was you showed a lot of versatility, especially coming in as a rookie, and not just a rookie, but off of where your starter was injured, and you were just kind of not thrown into the mix, but certainly it wasn't as if you were the anointed starter. You have obviously a very credentialed rookie season, and then to be cut, I think it was, it had to, for you, kind of cast doubt on, you know, what's wrong here? I, like you said, I go out, race aside, prove myself, and to know this team could have won with you has to leave a sour taste in your mouth.
Well, absolutely. And then plus, you know, you have to take into consideration that I had no preseason training. You know, that 3-day camp was basically, you know, just, you know, throwing balls. There was no cerebral approach to the game. You know, I had no game plans to follow. In fact, the first game that I entered, where we almost pulled it out in the last 10 minutes, I only had like 6 or 7 plays. So, you know, I had to basically rely on athleticism, street ball mentality, if you will. Early on I had a few interceptions, but a lot of it was because, hey, I didn't, you know, I had no formal training in terms of reading plays and all that stuff. So they stuck me out there basically, you know, just to wing it. And
right.
as the season went along, as I began to get more of a menu and began to get more at ease with what I was doing mentally, you know, the interceptions calmed down, and my completions and productivity came about, you know. So, but I went out there, you know, basically initially with nothing, you know.
Right.
And really to pull it off like that, like it happened, was really kind of an amazing, an amazing event.
Well, you are nicknamed the magician, so.
Well, I just went back to, you know, like playing college ball and, the way I played in college and, just let it go, you know. And
well, I think too, Marlon. But it's very interesting.
Right.
I don't think, and you had mentioned, I don't think people really get a chance to appreciate what you were doing because it was very much in the present. It was very much in the moment. You weren't, unlike, for example, a guy like Jackie Robinson, where there's multiple games and people knew about him, you were really thrown into the mix. And to a certain degree, I'll be the one to say it. I think what Denver did to just kind of cast you away, and because then you had to move into a Bills organization where with a guy like with Kemp, it was going to be very difficult for you to stay with the Bills and know there was a quarterback position, because Denver kind of pushed you right under the rug, and they did a in a way that they were there. The racism that was shown there was so subtle, it would have been hard for you to come out publicly because you were in now a Bills organization where they have a starting quarterback who is prominent in the league, and so what you were able to accomplish was very it was kind of thrown away because it was not you weren't a starter, as you said. You didn't go into the season. You were never really given that starting quarterback, quote unquote. You know that the press and the junkets that come with that.
Well, what happened was, you know, they during the off season, I lacked 6 hours to graduate, so I went back to my college to finish up the 6 hours, and I got a call from somebody in Denver, and they were talking about the fact that they had acquired Pete Lisk from Canada, and that they were having quarterback meetings, and I wasn't even invited. I'm the starting quarterback, you know, runner up for Rookie of the Year, set a Denver rookie record, and the thing that hurt me was I never thought that, you know, I should have been handed the job as starting quarterback. You know, they had Steve Tensley coming back, and then they acquired Pete Lisk from Canada. But I at least thought I would get an opportunity to compete. And they were holding these quarterback meetings without me. And so it was kind of funny because after I completed my degree and got my diploma, you know, I went back to Denver, and standing outside the office, when Steve Tensley, Lisk, and Saban came out of the office, Saban couldn't even look me in the eye, you know, because they didn't know that I knew. And so it was obvious, you know, that I was not going to get a fair shake, and that proved right in training camp. I mean, it's like, you know, I wasn't even there, you know. So I didn't get cut from Denver. I asked to be released because I thought I would get a fair shake with another team based upon, you know, my performances during the 68 season. Well, for some reason, Saban opted to give me my release, but he wanted to wait for 4 days. And I always wondered why he wanted to wait 4 days. Well, within the 4 days, nobody would touch me. So, you know, my thought was, you know, I was blackballed, and you know, that was it. So
you basically felt like he did that purposely, so you would have a hard time catching on.
Exactly.
Elsewhere.
Exactly. So
when you say catching on, Marlon, do you mean catching on as a quarterback, or literally inside of the league in and of itself?
No, quarterback.
Quarterback.
That's what I thought. That's what it's important to clarify that. It's important to clarify that because, certainly, as I said, that is a very intelligent, overt form of racism where they certainly want to keep you in the league, but they want to do their best. It's important to, you know, not have a team that does recognize, hey, this is a guy who had an unbelievable, you know, rookie season, let alone any segment of the season, and we're going to, at least like you said, we may not give him the starting role, but we'll sign him. He'll go number two, maybe number three on the depth chart. We'll start to see, you know, if we do log hours with him, do log training with him, what can we get, you know, from him in a year's time, in 2 years' time?
Right. But, you know, I think that, you know, based upon, you know, what I think I could have brought to the table, I could have at least have been their second-string quarterback. I'm not saying that I should have gone in ahead of Steve Tensley. I do feel that if given the opportunity, you know, I could have been a perfect complement as a backup to Steve because he was basically, you know, a classic drop-back quarterback. He didn't have hardly any mobility. So I could have come in and perhaps you know, change the complexion of the game. You know, and no disrespect to Pete Lisk, but because his situation never turned out, you know, with Denver. Never did turn out. But
now, unfortunately, you eventually signed with the Buffalo Bills, and you switched to the wide receiver position. Playing for the Bills, did you still have that bitterness? Did the bitterness still linger? And since you had
it's funny that you mentioned that, because James Harris, every time we talk and we go out on speaking engagement, he's always saying how bitter I was. But I wasn't really bitter, because if I was bitter, I would have quit. You know, after what they did to me, I would have quit. I mean, you know, when somebody's bitter, they basically kind of give up. You know, I never gave up. And I wasn't bitter, but by the same token, you know, I was going to fix the situation, you know. I never played wide receiver in my life. As a matter of fact, when Saban refused to give me an opportunity, and you know, I asked for my release, I went up to Canada for BC Lions for one day, and they were gonna let me play quarterback and corner. I just didn't like Canadian football. No disrespect to Canadian football. So I called Buffalo. And Jack Kemp and Tom Flores, and they had just drafted James Harris. And I'm thinking to myself, I said, if I had not have been successful at Denver in 1968, James Harris would never have gotten drafted as a quarterback in 1969. So I was proud of that, you know, accomplishment. So when I get to Buffalo, all three of those guys are hurt. So my first 3 days there, I was throwing. I was throwing, and then at the end of practice, I had to learn how to play wide receiver position I had never played before. So I'm losing all of this time, you know, trying to learn the wide receiver position while filling in throwing until these guys got healthy. So it was quite an accomplishment to be able to pull it off. But they were pretty patient with me. One thing is because I negotiated my own contract again, and I told them, well, I'm not going to come in here and sign a contract unless you don't cut me until the last cut, because I wasn't just going to come in there at a position I'd never played before and, you know, get cut and, you know, waste my time. And I only had like 3 weeks to make the team. So that's what happened. You know, I stuck it out. And
so I didn't get in the game
until the last game. And see, I had already beat the Bills twice as a quarterback, beat Kemp and, you know, the other players. And so they let me in the last 10 minutes, just like they let me in the last 10 minutes against the Patriots. My first game that I got in, and Jack Kemp, you know, he knew my history, he knew my pain and all that stuff. And so I got in the game, and he just kept firing me the ball. And I was making all these circus catches. How, I don't know. At the end of the game, I was the leading receiver, and they couldn't cut me.
So you spent 2 years in Buffalo, and eventually you went to Miami. You were a part of the 72 Dolphins.
Three years in Buffalo. Yeah.
And eventually you went over to Miami, and you won a Super Bowl with the 72 Dolphins. You won two Super Bowls, actually, with the Dolphins.
Right.
And you were a part of the undefeated team.
Right.
How did it feel to be a part of the undefeated team?
I started all 3 years I was there. Huh?
Started all 3 years.
Right.
And you made the transition to wide receiver, effectively. But how did it feel to be undefeated and then win the title with the Dolphins?
Well, you know, I went to Buffalo, and you know, that first year, I ended up most valuable player over OJ, and because I had never, you know, like I said, I had never played that position before, but you know, eventually, you know, I learned the position and became a pretty good receiver. Then the next year, I lead the league in receptions and make all pro. And then the third year, to be honest, third year is show you how crazy life is. You know, I'm still an accomplished receiver, but we were 1-13. We were 1-13, and the only team we beat was the Dolphins. So it ended up, you know, I'm playing out my option, and guess who the head coach becomes? Lou Saban. From Denver.
Wow.
So the same coach that jacked me around my rookie year is now become the head coach at Buffalo. But see, now he's dealing with me on a different level now. I'm established, and you know, made all pro and been established as one of the top receivers in the league. But he didn't want to deal with that. So the Dolphins had just lost to Dallas in the Super Bowl because they had double-teamed Paul Warfield. And I always had my best games against the Dolphins for some reason. So they were looking for somebody to offset Paul Warfield on the other side. Although, you know, Howard Twilley, he could do a good job. But at that point, that was their thinking. And so they paid a number one draft choice for me to join the Dolphins, and the rest is history. I went from a 14th round draft choice to a number one draft choice.
Marlon, when you sit back and you think in terms of, especially in terms of the breadth of your career, as you say, coming in, negotiating a contract just so that you were given 3 days reps as a quarterback, you actually get in and start as a quarterback, and you have an extremely successful career as a wide receiver, and again, having the wherewithal to know, hey, I'm going to negotiate a contract that's going to give me just a chance to, again, show that I have this ability, because it seems like every time you made sure you had a chance, not only did you take advantage of the opportunity, but you secured you know, your place in terms of that position with that opportunity.
Well, you know, like I said, I negotiated my own contract for the first 4 years I was in the league. The only time I secured an agent was when I started making some kind of money with the Dolphins. And, you know, I listened to the sage advice of, you know, people around the league to, you know, kind of feel my way around, you know, contract negotiations and, you know, back in those days, you know, agents were looked upon as pariahs. You know, a lot of managers and coaches, they don't want to deal with it. But I felt that I knew enough about, you know, negotiating a contract, especially since I wasn't making that kind of money. But if I was going to stay in the league, you know, if I was going to stay in the league, then I had to do certain things to make sure that I got an opportunity, you know, to compete and without ruffling the feathers of management. You know, I took a beating, you know, contract-wise, but it helped me get an opportunity to continue, you know, in the league. And it also helped me, you know, to you know, further my career and, you know, get an opportunity to play with the Dolphins. If I hadn't negotiated that contract, that they couldn't cut me, the last cut. I mean, I had never played wide receiver on any level. So, you know, they could have brought me in there for a week and cut me, you know. Cause,
right.
You know, certainly I wasn't going to be that impressive, you know, the first week. You know, first of all, I didn't have a lot of speed because I was a quarterback. Everything I did was left to right, you know, not straightforward. So I had to learn how to run, you know, so I, and, you know, of course, catch balls and, you know, a lot of things that helped me.
So
the fact that I was a quarterback and, you know, I knew where my receivers were supposed to be. You learn as a quarterback. You have a ball all the time, so most quarterbacks have good hands.
Right.
So, you know, I had a lot of pluses going for me, but hey, I still, you know. And then I only had like 3 weeks. It was less than 3 weeks to make a team at a position at the professional level that you've never played before. That's almost impossible.
Right.
But
man,
I did it. And it wasn't for Jack Kemp throwing me all those balls. And, you know, it would never have happened.
Now, you eventually you finished your career with the New England Patriots, and you retired in 1976 at the end of the year, end of that season.
Right.
Ultimately, you went on to you were a broker, actually. You sold
right.
municipal bonds. But unfortunately, you ran into some problems with drugs. What happened there? How did you end up going down that path?
Well, you know, I got to L.A. and, you know, I was working in Century City, which is the financial hub of Los Angeles. And, you know, I had a house and Mercedes and, you know, single. And, you know, I got caught up in that L.A. lifestyle, you know, Hollywood, you know. And, you know, I started letting my guard down, started hanging with people that, you know, I shouldn't have been hanging with. You know, even on my job, you know, drugs were available. I just, you know, let my guard down and, I was the kind of person that everybody trusted, you know, to watch out. I was, you know, player rep for Buffalo and Miami. I had good investments. You know, I went to school during the off season, or worked during the off season, so I was always prepared. So I thought,
right.
to quit the game. And but the fact that, you know, I didn't have to practice or work out, because I was a workaholic in terms of working out. I mean, nobody would work out with me. There were only a couple guys. And so I didn't have to work out anymore. And, you know, I got to party too much.
Right.
And next thing I knew, you know, I was the only one at the party.
And eventually you would, I guess, when you eventually went to prison, was that
right.
rock bottom for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And was that the turning point, you think, in your life?
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I went to jail in San Diego, you know, it was like, okay, here you are. Cement and steel, and you get a chance to think about all the things that you did, the positive things that you did, and then the negative things that you did, and you get a chance to think about it. Because while I was on the street, I would want to quit, but I was still on the street, so even though.
Right.
You know, even though I wanted to quit, I'm still on the street. I still have the freedom to go use. But when I was in that San Diego jail, and you look, you know, you're looking up at the, you know, at the, you know, from your bunk bed, at the steel and concrete, and you realize, hey, this is where you put yourself.
And Marlon, I think one of the questions. It's so interesting to hear you to speak about the trials and tribulations. I wonder, though, when you say you're there and you're thinking, was there points where you kind of said to yourself, you know, not so much how did all of this happen, but like you had said, living that L.A. lifestyle, did you ever get to a point and say, you know, I should have expected the same level that I played in the pros when I was retired or when I was working, because if anything, you say you kind of let your guard down and look what happens. Did you ever kind of go on a self-discovery journey and say, not where, how did I get here? I think you probably knew that, but it, that maybe you could have done more for yourself post-retirement than you did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And actually, as I look upon it, I should have been in that jail cell a lot earlier. You know, I escaped death. I escaped, you know, a lot of things that, you know, could ended me up in the morgue. You know, homelessness, and I lost everything. And, you know, the thing is that when you're on drugs, you don't care. You know,
right.
All you want is that, you know, more drugs.
Now, Marlon, there is a movie in production about your life called The Magician.
Yes.
How far along is it, and when should we expect the movie to come out?
Well, Greg Howard, who wrote Remember the Titans, and he wrote Ali, he's writing the movie script, and he's about a week or two away from completing the script. And then after that, you know, we start the investment portion and then production. John Beasley, who was a compass actor. He was in Stand Tall. He's been in Rudy. He's been in a couple of accomplished movies. You know, he spearheaded this entire movie project. And you know, once Greg gets the screenplay written within the next week or so, then you know we start gearing up for production. It's a movie. I mean, it's kind of it's a movie that I think that regardless if it was about me or anybody else, or anybody that would have my experience, it should be told.
Right.
To let people
and
know.
And judging by the stories that you told us today, I mean.
Yeah, I mean.
It should look good on the big screen.
Yeah. Well. You know, you want to project the fact that you can never give up. You know, I never gave up the fact that, you know, I could kick drugs. It took me a long time. But even though, you know, what happened to me in the quarterback position.
Now, real quick, Marlon, where else are you doing now?
I just retired from the Boys and Girls Club. I've been with the Boys and Girls Club for 12 years. And I own a business, I own a storage business. And so I'm just taking care of my storage business and gotten back into coaching high school quarterbacks. So that's
okay.
What I'm doing.
Now, you can also find more information about this movie at www.MarlonBriscoeMovie.com. That's www.MarlonBriscoe, which is MARLIN, Briscoe, which is BRISCOE, movie.com. So make sure you go there if you want to find out about the movie and find out about this man's great life. And he's overcome a lot, and he's there to talk about it. He's here to talk about it, and it's exciting to hear your story, Marlon. And we definitely thank you for stopping by, sir. It was enlightening, and you have an amazing story there, sir.
Well, thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
It was great talking to you.
Okay, buddy.
Take care.
All right. You too.
All right.
Now, that's something, Paul, you don't get a chance to do every day. Certainly, as I told you, I was excited to hear from him. I was taken aback. I'm sure you were, and we'll be probably speaking a little bit more of our thoughts in later shows, but that was certainly a little bit phenomenal, speechless, for a big mouth like me.
Well, yes, and it was a great story, and it was an honor to talk to the man and speak to the man. And life is interesting. I mean, he overcame a lot, and you know, if it wasn't for guys like Marlon Briscoe, there wouldn't be guys like Randall Cunningham, Warren Moon, Donovan McNabb, Dante Culpepper, Doug Williams, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, big props to him for dealing with what he dealt with to get to where he needed to get to. That's our show for tonight. I want to thank Marlon Briscoe for stopping by. For Jeremy Yesney, this is Paul Gant. You can listen to past shows at blogtalkradio.com/PGant. That's blogtalkradio.com/PGant. Take care. See you later. Bye.